For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm Robert Crockwood, and coming up this week,
environmental campaigner Mark Linus takes us through his new book, Our Final Warning, 6 Degrees of Climate Emergency.
Author Joanna Toy joins us with a new Shop Girls book, Heartache for the Shop Girls.
After her passing, we look at some books written by Dame Vera Lynn from the RNIB Library.
All that plus books of your life coming up in today's show.
Mark Linus's new book, Our Final Warning, 6 Degrees of Global Emergency, investigates what happens if, as predicted, global temperatures rise between 1 and 6 degrees during the 21st century. It's a chilling, timely, and compelling reminder that the human race needs to change its ways. He joined me over Zoom to tell me more about his research and the book. Mark, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red. It's great to be with you.
Now, this really is our final warning, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately it is. And I titled the book that because I wrote an earlier, completely different version of this idea, if you like, the 6 degrees idea, looking at the future impacts of climate change back in 2007. And so I wanted to say really that we're now at a situation which, I mean, how to put it other than it is our final warning. We don't have any more time to go on putting off cuts to climate-changing greenhouse gas emissions if we want to avoid some of the really more catastrophic end of impacts that I detail in the book.
Well, I was looking back at your previous book, which we also have in the RNIB library, and it's very depressing to see that a lot of the things that you've predicted have started to happen already.
Yes, it's depressing, but it's, I guess, reassuring that we've got the science right. So if the world had suddenly started cooling for the last 15 years and glaciers had started advancing again and we were seeing the opposite of what we expected, that would be really interesting. But the fact is that things have pretty much played out as was predicted back then by computer models and expectations for what warming would bring. And some of those impacts are pretty depressing. I mean, I remember snorkeling on coral reefs, maybe in the 1990s. All of those are dead now. And it was one of the earliest things which was predicted, big outbreak of coral bleaching across the world's tropical oceans. And something like half the Great Barrier Reef has now died. So it's not comforting to see that the scientists have been right about some of the worst things that would happen, and which have happened in some cases much earlier than was originally predicted.
In the book, you break it down degree by degree as to, well, the canaries in the mine that will die if we don't stop heating the world's atmosphere. What happens if we only increase by 1 degree?
Well, we're already in the 1 degree world. So that chapter is describing the impacts that we're already seeing, such as the mass disappearance of the world's corals. And also the melt of Greenland and Antarctica has really defied all expectations and happened more rapidly than certainly I was expecting 10, 15 years ago. At one point last year in 2019, Greenland was losing something like 600 billion tons of ice, which was enough to raise global sea levels by 2 millimeters in just 2 months. We've seen also the very rapid disappearance of the Arctic sea ice. In fact, in the UK at the moment, we're having this very strange seesaw between an incredibly wet period in the late winter, and February was really wet. And now we've suddenly got the sunniest and probably the driest spring ever. And so you're actually seeing weather patterns stuck in these configurations, which may well trace back to the disappearing Arctic sea ice. So these are some of the things that we're seeing, and I actually quantify in the book what the amount of extra heat is that's now being captured in the Earth system due to this increasing amount of greenhouse gases which we've got accumulated in the atmosphere. And it adds up to 6 zettajoules per year, which is 6 to the power of 21. And it's the same heat as 3 Hiroshima atomic bombs exploding in the oceans every single second.
Goodness. And at 2 degrees?
Well, at 2 degrees, we'll sadly see the loss of about 99% of the world's coral reefs. So it'll be a biome which more or less ceases to exist across the planet, and the first of many, unfortunately. We'll see tens of millions of more people exposed to exceptional lethal heat waves. We'd also begin to see impacts on the world's food supplies, which is something I'm very concerned about. Given that we're projected to see population growing to 9 or 10 billion by 2050, if we see a net reduction in the amount of food which is available, that would reduce the amount of calories available per person. And the projections at the moment are about another 500,000 additional deaths from malnutrition by mid-century. And there's also, in terms of the Earth system, the risk of tipping points. So we'd lose about 40% of the permafrost, that frozen ground in the Arctic, which when it melts, releases methane and carbon dioxide in the hundreds of billions of tons potentially. So even if we arrest the warming at 2 degrees, all of that extra carbon coming from the Arctic permafrost could then take us over that level and continue the warming further than you'd want. So that's always the danger, really, is that if we continue emitting fossil fuels and allowing the warming to accelerate, then that probably triggers tipping points in the Earth system, which then, while not necessarily making it unstoppable, add more warming into the system in decades to come.
Now, we're in the middle of a global pandemic, which is also labelled as a global emergency. Do you find a rather bitter irony that the entire world's way of living and economy can be put on hold for something that will probably kill fewer than 500,000 people, all told? And yet we can't do the same to stop the environment that we live in being destroyed.
I'm not sure it's ironic. I think it's entirely understandable, and I'm strongly in favour of all measures that are taken to reduce the death rate from the pandemic. 500,000 people in a very short space of time is a pretty serious thing, and I'm sure many of us have lost friends and family in the pandemic. In terms of the environmental lessons, if you like, in some ways it's extraordinary that with, as you say, the closing down of much of the world's economy, including most travel and so on, that the actual annual emissions reduction from this is probably less than 10%, probably about 8%, which doesn't sound like very much. And it does make you think that all of the lifestyle change type things that we're always urging each other on to do in terms of like reducing your flying on holidays and getting an electric car, that kind of stuff, isn't going to add up to a complete transformation of the global economy. A lot more has to happen. Having said that, if we were to maintain 8% reductions year on year, we would probably still make the 1.5 degree target. So if we emerge from the pandemic, which hopefully we'll do soon, in a way which doesn't go back to reopening the fossil fuel economy and transitions us much more rapidly to something more sustainable living based on clean and green power sources, then we could still make some of the more ambitious targets for reducing climate change.
I must say, like you, I have found the unanimity with which clean air and the kind of bird song that I can hear in the background as I'm interviewing you, everybody has enjoyed the improvement in our living environment during lockdown. Obviously, it's only a small positive for many people, but it does show the way and the potential for us to be able to change if we really want to.
To an extent, and it's funny actually, in some of the things that it's forced me to reassess are just habits that I had of driving to the gym or stuff like that. And you think, well, why was I doing that? You get sort of stuck in patterns of living that actually, when you are forced out of them because of something like a pandemic and a lockdown, you think, well, I'm actually not going to go back to that. And I think many of us will have the same feeling about long distance travel. You know, we're talking on Zoom now, it's been Zoom this, Zoom that, Zoom for everyone, even your granny can now use Zoom. We don't need to do all of this traveling, certainly from a business perspective. So there's lots of ways I think that life is going to be very different. Also, there's a lot of talk now about not bringing back cars to city centres. And I've seen a dramatic shift towards cycling. You know, I'm talking to you from the Welsh borders, which is normally quite a car heavy area. And there's just bikes everywhere. So let's not go back to where things were. But there's a lot more that needs to happen. We need to continue to decarbonize the power sector. We need to make sure that we do have some bridge to a sustainable future, which decarbonizes aviation, agriculture, some of these much more difficult things which we're really only beginning to think about.
Now, the book has been brought vividly to life by narrator Richard Burnip, and I always think it's quite a difficult job to bring this kind of book to life in an entertaining way that doesn't just confront you with endless statistics. Did you have anything to do with his selection as a narrator?
I didn't, and I wasn't even aware until I looked up on Amazon. But he sounds like one of those people who just has a wonderful voice for nonfiction and, as you say, really brings something to life. So I'm delighted that it worked out that way and that he was able to voice the book.
And do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
Never. It's funny, actually, when I listen to podcasts, I just wish I could put things on double time and just speed it up. I need to get through a lot of information as quickly as possible. I'm not a complete speed reader, but I do quite like being able to skip ahead, which is something you can do with text on a page, and you can't obviously do with the more linear format of audio. But so no, I'm not much of a podcaster or an audiobook listener, but I know a lot of people are, and it's so great that it's a format that really works for people.
Well, actually, you can speed up the rate at which you listen to an audiobook with all the main providers. So perhaps that's a new area of research for you.
Yeah, I'll give it a try in that case. I don't know whether the pitch of people's voices goes up if you speed them up by two or three times, but that's certainly a risk I'm prepared to take. So I'll give that one a shot.
Well, most of them will give you a free trial. But in the meantime, let's have a listen to Richard Burnip narrating Our Final Warning by my guest, Mark Lynas.
While there have been positive shifts, such as declining coal use in some countries and cheaper renewable energy, these are dwarfed both by rising emissions and an alarming trend towards denialism. By this, I don't just mean the overt climate of denial of some US politicians stupid enough to call global warming a hoax on Twitter. Nor am I simply referring to the populist backlash that seriously threatens liberal democratic values and has brought the political far right back into international ascendancy for the first time since the defeat of Hitler. 2007 already seems a much gentler world. I'm talking, in addition, about the kind of denial that we all practice, the implicatory denial of climate change, that allows us to keep on living our lives as usual, despite the obvious implications of what climate scientists are telling us. It's as if we don't really believe them. After all, it's still possible, just, to pretend that the world isn't warming, or that the rate of change is nothing exceptional, or that the warming we see could be the result of natural cycles or some such. Even the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, admits this. In its 2014 report, IPCC experts stated that rising greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere due to human activity are only extremely likely to have been the dominant cause of observed warming since the mid-20th century. In IPCC speak, extremely likely translates to a precise, numerically quantified meaning of 95 to 100% probability. So yes, that does allow for a 5% probability that climate change is either natural or inexplicable with current knowledge. However, in 2019, a team of scientists re-evaluated these probabilities. Looking at three data sets of observed atmospheric temperatures combined with climate model outputs, they concluded that there is only a 1 in 3.5 million chance that current global warming is natural. That translates into about a 0.00003% chance that the US Republican Party is right. As the scientists wistfully conclude, humanity cannot afford to ignore such clear signals.
Your book is incredibly well researched. It has rather been your life's work over the last 15 or so years. Do you see a coming together of scientific and political will on climate change, or are the two still separated by the need for votes and economic success?
Before the pandemic, I felt there was a real sense of momentum. You had the school strikers movement, Extinction Rebellion in the UK and elsewhere. And so the protester end of things was really beginning to capture the mainstream. And in the UK, we've got now a net zero target, which was unthinkable 10 years ago when I was writing the first iteration of this book. So I think it's okay to be encouraged by that. But we've got to make sure that we meet these targets and hopefully even exceed them, because at the current time, the pledges that the world's governments have put forward to meet the 2015 Paris Agreement don't meet the targets of the Paris Agreement, which was 1.5 to 2 degrees. In fact, if you add all of the government pledges together, it takes us still all the way up to 3 degrees, which is pretty unimaginable in terms of the scale of the impacts that we'd then experience. So there's just a huge amount more to do. And we need to not lose the momentum that was there before the pandemic. And in fact, we need to take the lessons that we've learned from dealing with a global crisis in the very short term and somehow leverage these lessons into dealing with the climate crisis, which is more obviously of a medium and a long-term challenge.
And I think that seeing government scientists on the television every night maybe means that they are less distant to the public than they were beforehand. Perhaps we're trusting them and taking what they say more into our day-to-day lives.
Up to a point, I think there's also a danger of politicians hiding behind scientists. There's been a pretty constant refrain from the UK government that we're following the science, which in any situation would be welcome. But there are unavoidably political decisions that need to be taken, which involve balancing between competing objectives. And you can see this with the pandemic response, of course. Yes, you want to save lives by continuing social distancing and lockdown measures for as long as is necessary to do that. But at the same time, we're running out of money and millions of people are out of work and businesses are going to be going under. So you also need to begin to reopen the economy. And those are political decisions which are based on some sense of the balance of risk and other things like that. So you can't just say, well, the scientists have told us to do something and that's where we are. And I think the same thing applies to climate change. The scientists can tell us, well, there's a 60% chance that we're going to miss the 2 degrees target if we don't meet such and such a carbon budget. But it's a political decision for all of us and our political representatives about whether we want to run that risk, because we want to avoid the risk of economic pain in the meantime.
So if we imagine ourselves in 10 years' time, where do you think we'll be?
Well, I'm not a futurist. And while this book is a scientific project, it's also a piece of advocacy. So I want to change the kind of world that we see by writing a book like this. And one would hope that issuing a final warning of 6 degrees would help, to whatever small extent, push forward that momentum that we, I think, are seeing in terms of how climate change is dealt with. It's very difficult to make predictions about what kind of world we're going into, even in the very short term, of course, because we don't know how rapidly we're going to be able to exit from the pandemic. We don't know what the economic situation is going to be, whether it's going to be one of panic and collapse or a much more managed recovery. If it's the latter, then we have a higher chance, I think, of pushing with recovery funds into a much more sustainable future, because there'll be a need for a lot of investment and job creation, and that can go into things which decarbonize the economy. The thing is, you can probably tell from my tone, I'm a fairly irrevocable optimist. I don't know why. I mean, there's plenty of stuff to be pessimistic about, but there's also things that we've successfully achieved in the past. We don't have a population of, what is it, more than 7 billion by accident. It's because we've been incredibly successful as a species in harnessing the planet to meet our needs with food production and modern healthcare and those kinds of things. So it's incredible what humanity can achieve when we as a species put our minds to something. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't have equal success with at least limiting the more dramatic impacts of climate change and not destroying the one planet that we have and call home.
Well, I think that's a good optimistic note to end the interview on. Mark Lynas, thank you for leading us through our final warning, and let's hope that your optimism is borne out when I come to interview you about the sequel in a few years' time.
I will return with great joy, and we'll look back together on how successfully we dealt with this crisis. Yes, let's end on that note.
Our final warning, 6 degrees of Climate Emergency, joins Mark Lynas's other books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Mark will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. Last time we met Joanna Toy, it was to talk about A Store at War, the first in a series of novels about a fictitious Midlands department store called Marlowe's during the Second World War. With the third book in the series, Heartache for the Shop Girls, just about to enter the RNIB library, I thought it high time to find out the latest developments in the life of the staff of Marlowe's, where it's now 1942.
She looked across to furniture and household, hoping to catch Jim's eye, but he was with a customer. He was tipping a kitchen chair this way and that, demonstrating its sturdiness. He took his job very seriously. Jim took lots of things seriously, and plenty not so seriously. It was a combination that had first attracted her to him. But whether he was testing her or teasing her, Lily had accepted the challenge. Miss Collins, customer. Lily snapped to attention and smoothed down her dress as Mrs. Mortimer approached. She was one of the first customers Lily had served after her promotion from junior to sales, and a kind, tweedy soul. So it had been a gentle dunking, not a baptism of fire. Mrs. Mortimer would only be looking, or doing a recce, as she put it, on behalf of one of her busy daughters or daughters-in-law, before she or they returned with the essential coupons to make the purchase. But it was all good practice. Lily began as she had been taught. Good morning, Mrs. Mortimer. How are you? How may I help you?
Becky Wright, narrating Heartache for the Shop Girls, written by Joanna Toy, who joined me over Zoom.
Hi, Jo, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much, Red. Doing great.
So, as I said, it's now summer 1942 at Marlowe's, and the customer still comes first, although things like rationing and returning soldiers are really bringing the realities of war home to everybody.
Yes, it's a tough time really for department stores, a bit like now. It was very difficult for them to get the goods to sell, particularly luxury goods that their customers would have been used to. But as well as the luxury of the department store, Lily's home life is much more modest. So we also see the difficulties that her mother has in just putting food on the table. And she's having to get ever more inventive, thanks to sort of wartime food flashes and cooks like the wonderful Marguerite Patton, who were bringing out recipes for delicious things like oatmeal and lentil sausages, which perhaps we should be eating more of these days, which might be quite delicious, really, perhaps if you put the right herbs in with them.
The book opens with a welcome home for Les, a young man who's been away fighting in the North African desert. And exactly that, Dora has done her absolute best to recreate the kind of cake that he would have expected before wartime.
That's right. When there was a party or any celebration, people did tend to pool their rations. So everybody would give their sugar ration so that somebody could make a cake, that kind of thing. Of course, the irony was that although the army food could be quite repetitive and in the desert was a lot of dehydrated, not very nice stuff, if you were posted at home, the food tended to be much better because supplies were prioritised for the fighting forces to keep them in good fighting shape. So Les has been out in the desert, that's right. Les is married to Beryl, who started as a shop girl with Lily and Gladys, the other young woman who works at Marlowe's department store. But Beryl has had a baby now, so she is being a young mum. Les hasn't seen the baby. He was away when the little baby's born. So there's a lot to catch up on, really, when everybody gets back together.
And again, as with the first two books, there's a real sense of community pulling together at a time of hardship, which really finds a resonance with readers during lockdown, as they've been expressing in their reviews online.
Yes, a lot of people have likened what we've been going through with the virus, the consequent lockdown, to what people went through in the war. There are lots of similarities, the queuing, although of course the queuing wasn't socially distanced in those days. And indeed the empty shelves, which of course came as such a shock because we're used to living in such a time of plenty. I mean, I think we have to remember that the lockdown, tough as it has been for many people, and blind people in particular, and partially sighted, it went on for what, 6, 7 weeks? The war went on for 6 years. And there was virtually a year, at least 9 months, where people were consistently getting no sleep because of bombing raids, especially over London, but all the major cities during the Blitz.
Yes, it really is a reminder of quite how resilient human beings can be and how they draw strength from each other.
That's very true. I mean, Lily and her colleagues, Lily and her family, Lily and her friends, the feeling that goes through all the books is, as you say, a strong one of community. And everything that they face together, really. Everybody mucks in and helps out. When Beryl, for example, has the baby on her own, it's Lily's mother, Dora, and Beryl's mother-in-law, Ivy, who are there with her. People had to get by without having some loved ones with them. particularly I think for the women left at home, there was a real bonding that happened. And that kind of thing, the way we've all rediscovered our neighbours and the acts of kindness that have come out during the coronavirus pandemic and are still going on, and the huge sacrifices that people have made. I mean, this time it was the NHS who were the frontline troops and care workers, as opposed to fighting forces. But there are so many similarities, and I think that's why people have perhaps this time particularly turned to Heartache for the Shop Girls, because of those echoes that you were talking about.
And I've been struck that your readership is really split quite evenly between men and women. These are timeless stories that appeal across the board.
Yeah, I found that really, really interesting. When I was able to do library talks before, of course, there was a general shutdown there, the audience would often be very mixed. I don't know whether it's that men in general are reading more or liking to read almost anything about the war. But I mean, I think it's really, really heartening. I always had a woman reader in mind for these books. I'll be perfectly honest. When you write something that's notionally a saga, they're thought to be women's fiction. But I've done a lot of research, not just about shops and retail in wartime, but about the war itself, because I'm moving quite slowly through the war. The first book was set in 1941, the second book early 1942 to the middle of 42. And as you say, book three, Heartache for the Shop Girls, which picks up from wartime for the shop girls, starts in the summer of 1942. So they're all pinned to actual events that happen in the war. There's been a big scare about Les, the young man who returns at the beginning of Heartache for the Shop Girls, in and around the Battle of Tobruk. Lily's brother Reg is also out in the Western Desert. And Gladys, the other shop girl, has a fiancé who is serving in the Navy. He's on a ship which is escorting the convoys. So I'm quite detailed in my research. It doesn't all go into the books because I'm not a historian and I'm not writing a social history. I'm writing something that I hope is dramatic and a page turner. But it's important to me to get the authentic details about the wartime life, daily life at home, and life insofar as I reflect it for the people who were the fighting forces, to get that correct, because I think that actually makes the story come alive more.
Marlowe's, the Edwardian emporium that is at the heart of the story, is a wonderful melting pot for all the members of different social strata. There are people of all classes working there and coming across its threshold.
Yeah, that's very true. I love the idea of an Edwardian emporium, and that's absolutely right. It's not the most modern of shops, even by wartime standards. Jim, who is or becomes over the course of the books Lily's young man, as they would have said then, is desperate to drag the store into the 20th century, and he's always suggesting lots of improvements, many of which can't be put in place because of wartime restrictions on labour and on materials. It is a very good setting. All these workplace settings are always very interesting because, exactly as you say, it's a community in itself and it has got every single level. We go from the store's owner, Cedric Marlowe, right down to the junior level, which is the entry level where Lily started. And in between, of course, there are the buyers who can be quite intimidating, as they were in those days. And even I remember shopping in stores in the 60s with my mum and working in them in the late 70s in my university holidays, and there were still individual department buyers in those days, and they wielded quite a lot of power, had a lot of responsibility, and could be quite severe, really.
You mention that the book has a female narrator, the wonderful Becky Wright, who I know you worked with very closely when you were editing and script writing for The Archers.
Yes, it's been a real joy that Becky's now the reader for these books. She was on The Archers for 10 years and I think had some great stories. I mean, the departure of her character, Nick, was one of the most resonant for many years and very topical in itself. She actually, unfortunately, died of sepsis. So Becky gives the books a real life and animation. And she did make me smile when she'd finished reading the second book, Wartime for the Shop Girls. I had a word with her and said, oh, thank you so much. I'd heard samples of it. And she does a subtle Midland accent, and she's all over with the smarter accents and so on for all the strata of society we've been talking about. And she said, yes, do you know, there were 40 different voices. And I said, I can't believe that. You're joking. Surely not, Becky. 20 maybe. I was trying to list the main characters in my head. But she made the point that in the second book, for example, Lily goes to quite a smart house where a maid opens the door. And the maid only has a line. All she has to do is turn around and say, oh, madam, you've got a visitor. But of course, Becky had to give her a voice all of her own. So I'm just very indebted to her for making the audio so lively and interesting. And I'm constantly in awe of actors and what they achieve, really, with words on a page.
Do you find yourself thinking in audio, having worked so long on The Archers? Or are you somebody who thinks with the written word?
That's such a good question. I do. I think in audio scenes, really. It's taken me a while to realise that basically I'm still writing dialogue with lots and lots of description and stage directions in between. I always really, really enjoy writing the dialogue. And when it comes to reading back what I've written, I read it aloud, which I always used to do with the Archer scripts, trying to do the accents. I mean, I won't do you my Joe Grundy, it's pitiful. But I very much hear what the characters are saying. And I also have to kind of choreograph it in my head because I'm so used to writing an Archer scene where you couldn't have characters jump across the microphone. If they came in a door on the right-hand side, they had to stay on the right-hand side as they approached to the centre of the microphone. So I always like to know exactly when someone has come in. Have they shut the door? Was that door open? Oh, they've got to sit in a chair. How many chairs have we got around the fire? Does someone need to bring a chair up? It might sound like really boring detail. And again, I don't always, of course, put it in. But for me, it just helps it to flow. I don't want to be stopping when I'm reading a book going, hang on a minute. Person's just got out of the shower and now someone's come to the door and they've opened it. You know, did I see them put their dressing gown on? So I do try to avoid things like that.
Were you surprised that The Archers went off air for a time during the lockdown and also didn't address the coronavirus?
To be perfectly honest, my first reaction when I heard about coronavirus and how we were going to lock down and how seriously it was going to have to be taken was, oh my goodness, I'm so glad I'm not writing The Archers at the moment, because I went through foot and mouth with The Archers, the BSE crisis, and I know what an enormous task it is when you've got scripts that have been written, scripts that are being recorded, scripts that are being planned, scripts that are on air, to suddenly do a kind of a U-turn and change everything that's in the programme. The Archers, it's like a huge big battleship, really, you know, and turning that round takes a long, long time. I think the pause that the archive episodes gave them was a very good idea to sort of take stock. And I think, I hope that the listeners really enjoyed those. It did sound a bit strange, of course, that we were all locked down and The Archers were still going about having their parties. In fact, they were doing their Easter egg rolling, I think, when of course there was none of that going on. But they've done the very best they could in the circumstances.
You obviously haven't been able to do as many events around the launch of the new book, but has that given you more time to concentrate on writing the fourth book in the series?
Ah, wow, you're asking me to give things away here. Yes, I guess it has, really. There is going to be a fourth book which comes out in the autumn. So the shop girls story very much continues. It's called Christmas for the Shop Girls because we all love something with Christmas in the titles. There's a very huge event which happens at the end of Heartache for the Shop Girls, which reverberates through that next book. But there's equal, if not more, drama ahead for Lily and her cohort of colleagues and friends.
Well, Joanna Toy, I hope you'll come back and join us in the autumn to talk about Christmas for the Shop Girls. But in the meantime, thank you so much for coming back on to Read On and taking us through the next episode of the Shop Girls series. Heartache for the Shop Girls by Joanna Toy joins the first two books in the series, A Store at War and Wartime for the Shop Girls, in the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, visit the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Dame Vera Lynn, the Force's sweetheart, passed away on the 18th of June 2020, at the age of 103. With songs such as We'll Meet Again and The White Cliffs of Dover, she inspired both troops abroad and civilians at home during World War II. RNIB Library has various books written by Vera Lynn, including Some Sunny Day, My Autobiography.
The funny thing is, I don't remember singing as a tiny child. It's only from my press cuttings that I know that apparently I could sing five songs right through by the time I was two. And I'm sure that when I was 2½, my Uncle George taught me two old favourites, Katie and I'm Sorry I Made You Cry, because I've been told this many times.
Born Vera Welsh on the 20th of March 1917 in the East End of London, Dame Vera's career was set from an early age. Along with her father, who also did a turn, she sang in working men's clubs from the age of just seven. She had a successful radio career with Joe Loss and Charlie Kuntz in the 1920s and 30s, but it was with World War II that she became the iconic figure that captured the imagination of the national public.
In many ways, we were just another typical working-class family. We were a small family, just me, my brother Roger, who was 3 years older than me, my parents, and my grandma, of course. I have very few recollections of my parents' parents, although I have some beautiful old-fashioned pictures of them all. I vaguely remember my mother's father, who died when I was 4 years old. From the photographs, you'd think that we were well off, because everyone was always dressed in their Sunday best if they were having their photograph taken, or if they were going out somewhere special. There's a favourite shot I have of one of my aunts wearing a tweed suit, a fur tippet and a hat on the beach. I even have a photograph of my father on holiday in the countryside wearing what looks like a bowler hat. It was not because people were wealthy that they dressed like that. They just wore their best clothes to go out. My mother, Annie, was a dressmaker, and my father, Bertram, did all sorts of jobs. To this day, I haven't the faintest idea how my parents met. I never asked them. They were just ordinary people to me. My mother was a bit smart, though, because of her dressmaking. She made all her own clothes. Before she was married, she worked for a London dressmaker who took on royal commissions. She was the one who taught me how to sew and make things properly. My father worked as a plumber, and he'd been on the docks. In those days, you took any job you could get. That's how it was when I was a child. Despite this, my father was an easy-going man who liked to laugh. And he was a very good dancer.
Narrator Diana Bishop reading from Some Sunny Day, My Autobiography by Vera Lynn, which lasts for 7 hours and 38 minutes. An earlier autobiography is also available from RNIB, called Vocal Refrain.
That there was something about my voice which appealed to servicemen began to reveal itself quite early in the war. For in March 1940, my name appeared at the top of a list of favourite female vocalists sent into a magazine by the men in the tank corps. There was nothing unusual in the list itself, because popular music fans, then as now, were always drawing up their own championship tables, just for the sheer fun of disagreeing with each other. Confined to girl singers working in this country, this one was a modest list in a modest publication, but it was a gratifying sign. The really big indication came in the next month and was turned into a national news item by Jonah Barrington of the Daily Express. I might as well quote the piece so that you can see what I mean. Headed, British Girl Wins BEF Radio Vote, it went on, a plumber's daughter from East Ham. The wide-eyed, open-faced Miss Vera Lynn tops BEF singing popularity poll. Bravo, Miss Lynn. Other tops were all American. Deanna Durbin, Judy Garland, Bing Crosby. How do I know? Because 3 weeks ago, the BBC's Mr. Leslie Perrone asked the troops to tell him which records they'd prefer him to play. And yesterday, his compere, Mr. John Glyn Jones, gave me the results. Says Mr. Glyn Jones, it seems they want sentiment rather than swing. Top tunes are Faithful Forever, Somewhere in France with You, and There's a Boy Coming Home on Leave. That cutting is dated 17th of April 1940. It didn't mean that from that moment onwards I was the Force's sweetheart. My theatre billing, after the fashion of the time, still had something along the lines of radio's sweet singer of sweet songs, just as Billy Bennett would always be almost a gentleman. But the Force's sweetheart idea sprang directly from that BBC BEF poll and the publicity given to it by the Daily Express. Leslie Perrone, who's now retired from the BBC, had to be reminded of the poll, but after a moment it all came back to him. We'd done a type of request programme back in 1938, and this was a Force's version of that idea. Its audience consisted of men of the British Expeditionary Force in France, and when we asked them to express a preference, the cards came flooding in, and Vera Lynn emerged as the clear favourite. It may have been the first popularity poll, outside the specialist magazines, ever held for what we used to call light music in those days. Whether that's true or not, it established a link between the armed forces and myself, which is unbroken to this day.
Phyllis Boothroyd narrating Vocal Refrain by Vera Lynn, which lasts for 7 hours and 31 minutes. And finally, there's We'll Meet Again by Robin Cross, Jenny Gex and Vera Lynn. This memoir is about how the war affected every aspect of day-to-day existence in Britain. Events portrayed range from the devastation of a child's life as he experiences the Blitz, to the almost comic advert for a blackout coat for pet dogs.
All kinds of songs and jingles run through my head from time to time, reminding me of the wartime days of rationing and salvage drives. If you lived through those times, you'll remember this one. Hey, little hen, when will you lay an egg for my tea? Hey, little hen, when will you try to supply one for me? Eggs were in short supply during the war, although no one worried much about salmonella then. It sounds more like something that was in cans on points and in short supply than a deadly disease. For much of the time, we made do with dried eggs. The strutting hen in the Ministry of Food advertisements assured us that dried eggs are my eggs, my whole eggs are nothing but my eggs. But a dried egg omelette left one with a few lingering doubts. Tommy Handley offered his radio audience his own inimitable variety of eggs, which were all singing, all humming, and all bummin. The only eggs that are all they're cracked up to be. With every dozen, we give away a gas mask. Itmar eggs can be whipped, but they can't be beaten. Imported fruits like bananas disappeared altogether. In the winter of 1944, I returned from a tour of duty with ENSA on the Arakan front in Burma. Taking pride of place among my souvenirs was a large bunch of bananas, an almost unknown sight in wartime Britain. There was a young mother standing on the railway station with her small son. She kept eyeing the bananas in disbelief and finally plucked up courage to come and ask me if she could have one for her little boy, as he'd never tasted one. I'm afraid the result of the tasting was an anticlimax, as he spat it out and said, "Yeah." In other words, he hated it. his introduction to this forbidden wartime fruit had been an unmitigated disaster. The same scene was to be repeated across the country after the war, when anxious mothers treated their tots to their first banana. One of the great battle cries on the home front was, "Dig for victory." "Dig, dig, dig, and your muscles will grow big. Keep on pushing the spade. Don't mind the worms, just ignore their squirms. And when your back aches, laugh with glee and keep on digging. Till we give our foes a wiggin, dig, dig, dig to victory." Britain had to be self-sufficient, and every spare patch of ground was turned over to cultivation. In Hyde Park, there were allotments in the shadow of the Albert Memorial. Rationing produced its frustrations, but it meant that the nation as a whole was much better fed than it had been in the 1930s, and, I suspect, than it is now. As part of the war effort, people were bombarded with information on the most economical and nutritious ways to use their rationed and unrationed food. Potatoes, which were unrationed, featured heavily in our diet. There was even a Christmas potato fair in 1942, held on a bomb site in Oxford Street. Each visitor signed a pledge. "I promise, as my Christmas gift to sailors who have to bring our bread, that I will do all I can to eat homegrown potatoes."
Carol Marsh, reading from We'll Meet Again by Vera Lynn, Robin Cross and Jenny Geggs, which runs for 7 hours and 39 minutes. For more information about these Vera Lynn books and for everything available from RNIB Library, head to Reading Services, that's all one word, readingservices.rnib.org.uk, or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now it's back to Mark Lynas for the books of his life. Mark, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, that book would have to be To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, which is probably the best small novel ever written. It just captures something about the kind of loss of innocence story, but at the same time captures something about the society that the American South was, and to a certain extent, well, a large extent still is, as in fact we've seen recently from the death of George Floyd, and just the extent to which America is still a society built on white power. In fact, it has a president who came to the White House through the exercise of white power political themes. And so that's a book which has not gone out of date, but it's written in such a warm and engaging style. Harper Lee's use of language and the characters and everything, it's just such an enchanting, enthralling tale. But of course it has that dark undertone which makes it all the more powerful.
"Jem," I said, "are those the Yules sitting down yonder?" "Hush," said Jem, "Mr. Heck Tate's testifying." Mr. Tate had dressed for the occasion. He wore an ordinary business suit, which made him look somehow like every other man. Gone were his high boots, lumber jacket, and bullet-studded belt. From that moment he ceased to terrify me. He was sitting forward in the witness chair, his hands clasped between his knees, listening attentively to the circuit solicitor. The solicitor, a Mr. Gilmer, was not well known to us. He was from Abbotsville. We saw him only when court convened, and that rarely, for court was of no special interest to Jem and me. A balding, smooth-faced man, he could have been anywhere between 40 and 60. Although his back was to us, we knew he had a slight cast in one of his eyes, which he used to his advantage. He seemed to be looking at a person when he was actually doing nothing of the kind. Thus he was hell on juries and witnesses. The jury, thinking themselves under close scrutiny, paid attention. So did the witnesses, thinking likewise. "In your own words, Mr. Tate," Mr. Gilmer was saying. "Well," said Mr. Tate, touching his glasses and speaking to his knees, "I was called, Could you say it to the jury, Mr. Tate? Thank you. Who called you?
Mr. Tate said,
I was fetched by Bob. By Mr. Bob Ewell, yonder. One night.
What night, sir?
Mr. Tate said, it was the night of November 21st. I was just leaving my office to go home when Mr. Ewell came in. Very excited he was.
Marvin Caine narrating To Kill a Mockingbird, written by Harper Lee. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, for rereading, that would have to be Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. In fact, any of the trilogy in five parts, as he amusingly put it. Just because it's so clever, and again, the ideas that he came up with were so smart and so penetrating in so many different ways. And it's just hilarious. I never get bored of that. And even though I know whole sentences off by heart, it's something that I will always, always gain amusement and insight from going back to.
Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd because on the whole it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place. And some said that even the trees had been a bad move, and that no one should ever have left the oceans. And then, one Thursday, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl, sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rickmansworth, suddenly realized what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could be made a good and happy place. This time it was right, it would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone about it, a terrible, stupid catastrophe occurred, and the idea was lost forever.
All of the books in Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series are available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, where the talking book versions are narrated by Gordon DeLieu. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I've just finished Hilary Mantel's The Mirror and the Light, which is the third part of the Wolf Hall trilogy about Thomas Cromwell, who was Henry VIII's chief minister after Cardinal Wolsey. And it really is an extraordinary piece of historical fiction, which brings the sort of courtly world to life in a way which no real history ever actually can. And how she's done it is, it's an absolute masterpiece. And the two earlier ones, so Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, both won the Booker Prize, and very deservingly so. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Where's my orange coat? He says. I used to have an orange coat. I have not seen it, says the boy, Christophe. He says it skeptically, as if he were talking about a comet. I put it away before I brought you here, while you were still across the sea, blessing a Calais dunghill with your presence. You scorn me. Christophe is offended. Yet it was I who caught the cat. You did not, Gregory says. It was Dick Purser caught the cat. All Christophe did, he stood by making hunting cries. Now he looks to get the credit. His nephew, Richard, says, you put that coat away when the cardinal came down. You had no heart for it. Yes, but now I'm feeling cheerful. I'm not going to appear before the bridegroom as a mourner. No, Christophe says. With this king, one needs a reversible garment. One never knows, is it dying or dancing? Your English is improving, Christophe. Your French is where it was. What do you expect of an old soldier? I'm not likely to write verse. But you curse well, Christophe says encouragingly. Perhaps the best I have heard. Better than my father, who, as you know, was a great robber and feared through his province. Would your father recognize you? Richard Cromwell asks. I mean, if he saw you now, half an Englishman and in my uncle's livery. Christophe turns down his mouth. By now he's probably hanged. Don't you care? I spit on him. No need for that, he says soothingly. Coat, Christophe, go and seek. Gregory says, the last time we all went out together, Richard says, do not say it, do not even think of the other one. I know, Gregory says amiably, my tutors have imbued me with it from my earliest days. Do not talk about severed heads at a wedding.
Ben Miles narrating The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel, which, like the other books in the trilogy, are available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Well, Mark Linus, thank you so much for sharing your obvious joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks, it's been a real pleasure.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week, but don't forget to tune in at the same time next week. Or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail, which is REDSZELL.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.